Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this May the 27th on the West Coast, now May the 28th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Windtalkers Radio Network around the world and want to wish everyone in the U.S. military, whether you're here in the States or stationed elsewhere around the planet, a very happy, wonderful, and peaceful Memorial Day, and a safe one as well. Before we bring on tonight's guest, Jim Murray, I just want to say that we have been across this nation suffering from very abnormal weather patterns, and that's one reason why we started a couple of minutes late tonight, internet problems. So you all have been going through this. I'm not alone. Neither is tonight's guest. But the aberrant weather, the tornadoes that people have experienced, certainly our prayers should continue to go out to those in Joplin, Missouri, but let's pray for the whole nation, especially during this holiday weekend. We shouldn't be suffering like this. And in upcoming shows, we'll go into more detail as to what is causing this. It's pleasant for some people to have a lot of rain, but I have to tell you, for me, it is not for me. Or should I say, but not for me.
Songs of love, but not for me. Oh, lucky stars above, but not for me. With love to lead the way, I found more clouds of gray than any Russian play could guarantee. I was a fool to fall and get that way. Hi-ho, alas and all, so lack-a-day. Although I can't dismiss the memory of her kiss, I guess she's not for me. Thank you.
but not for me. Ah, lucky stars above, but not for me. We'd love to lead the way. I found more clouds of gray than any Russian play could guarantee. I was a fool to fall and get that way. Ha ho, alas, and also lack a day. Although I can't dismiss the memory of a kiss, I guess she's not for me. I guess she's not for me.
But not for me. That was, or that is, Joey DeFrancesco, and on vocals, Joe Dogs. The saxophone was played by none other than the legendary Plas Johnson, who performed with many big bands throughout his career. Joe Dogs, who is that? Anyone recognize that voice? He was a co-star in the movie Goodfellas. Yes, that's right, Joe Pesci on vocals. With that, I'd like to invite tonight's guest. He enjoys organ music, although I don't know. He's never told me if it's pipe organ or the Hammond B3. He is a scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, my co-host on Friday nights, and our resident science advisor, Mr. Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to Evident Footprints.
Thank you very much, Don. Always good to be with you. That was an interesting tidbit of information. I'm very familiar with the film Goodfellas. And having grown up in that area, it always rang an interesting bell for me. But I didn't realize that Joe Pesci was also going by this other name. Am I correct in that?
Well, yeah, I think it was sort of a spoof. They put a picture of a Basset Hound puppy on the cover, and Joey's album ended up being called "Falling in Love Again," and Joe Dogs is actually Joe Pesci. Quite an excellent voice, very good intonation. Nice feel for the music, works the lyrics very nicely. I thought you'd get a kick out of that anyway. So,
well, I did, but I was also surprised, you know, to find out who it really was. So, there you go.
There you go. More truth. Well, what's happening in your neck of the woods these days? I mentioned the crazy weather. I'm sure you've been going through it there in the deeper heart of the Midwest.
Yeah, we got some really nasty storms earlier in the week. And as a matter of fact, we didn't get hit as hard as Joplin, Missouri, but quite a few people got killed in this neighborhood. And the damage to personal homes and things of that sort is pretty considerable. The one thing that I thought was exceptionally tragic was a little 3-year-old boy who literally got sucked up into a funnel, and they found his body in a lake several miles away 2 or 3 days later. So, I mean, it's hitting everybody, and there was a lot of personal destruction of homes and such, you know, which also has to be contended with.
Oh, that's bad news. Yeah.
So, I get the impression from some of the things you said that you're of the opinion that this weather is not entirely natural. And it certainly doesn't seem to be, I'll tell you. We were all crowded into a warehouse the other day, protecting our vehicles because the hail that falls around here is huge.
Yes.
And it can do your car in like, you know, a few minutes flat. And I'll tell you, just watching the patterns of the clouds in the sky and the incessant lightning strikes. I mean, it was unbelievable how many lightning strikes there were in that time period. It just gives you the feeling that all is not well.
No, certainly not. And there have been a lot of people, especially on internet radio, who have been coming out saying, oh, this is all caused by HAARP. That used to be the case, but currently that's not the case. And I've alluded to that on a number of occasions. This is something coming from space, we'll put it that way. And maybe next week you and I can do a complete show on the specifics of what's happening.
That would be interesting. And by the way, one of the things that becomes super obvious when you have these weather calamities, especially around here, is the fact that you tend to take electric power and all of the amenities associated with it for granted, you know, because you grow up with it. It's there all the time, and you're used to just flicking a switch or pressing a button and getting the results that you want.
Yes.
But it doesn't take too many minutes of being without it to realize how much your life would change if it weren't there at all. And it was that type of thinking that prompted me to maybe spend a few minutes talking about the relationship between energy and culture and, you know, where we came from in that regard and where we might be going if we're not careful. But, you know, it's a pretty well-defined relationship. You can't have one without the other, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, I agree with that. Any particular area you want to start off your discussion with, Jim?
Well, you know, the obvious place to start is probably at what we perceive to be the beginning. Of course, that may not be the beginning, and that's the whole point of this discussion. But if you go back to the so-called Stone Age, where people were supposedly wearing animal skins and living in caves, the only real source of power that they had for anything was fire. And according to traditional legend, they didn't even know how to make it. They used to wait until there was a lightning flash that hit a tree or something like that and started a fire. And then they'd run and get something that was burning. And actually, they had people called fire watchers. They would bring the fire into the cave and surround it with some rocks. And they had somebody there that was basically appointed to do nothing but keep throwing fuel on the fire so it never went out because they didn't know how to relight it. So that's a pretty amazing extreme when you consider, you know, something like a modern gas stove. You don't even think about it. You go over there and flick the dial and it comes on, and you throw a pot on top of it, and then you go turn on the TV, watch the news or something. You never think about the fact that it wasn't really that long ago, as far as timelines go, that you'd be furiously rubbing two sticks together or something to try and get a flint and a stone or something to try and get a fire started.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty amazing, really, when you stop and think of it.
There was a movie some years ago called Quest for Fire. Don Ray Chong was one of the stars of the movie. And they spent the whole movie basically raiding the various tribes in search of fire. And in the end, when they got it, they ended up falling in the water, crossing this body of water to get back into their territory. The whole movie is this quest for fire. and they ended up putting it out. But Don Ray Chong knew how to build a fire using a stick and flint and some feathery type of brush that she gathered together, and she would spin the rock or the stick between her palms of her hand and get it going. And it was quite an interesting movie. So you're reminding me of that. That's alleged to have occurred in the Stone Age, where people just grunted, you know, sort of like politicians do today. So
yeah, they're grunting all right. Well, the interesting thing is that I can give you some firsthand experience about that, the making of fire, because when I was a kid, I was really, really interested in surviving in the wilderness. And I took it upon myself to learn how to create fire from nothing, even though I had matches. I mean, I'd be crazy not to at least take them along with me, but, you know, I wanted to learn how to accomplish that without them in case I had to do it sometime. And I found the fire bow is probably the best and the quickest way to accomplish that, but it's really a lot more complicated to make a good one than most people think. And it's amazing how, when you actually have to try and do some of these things, it's really amazing how you begin to become conscious of the way in which we interact with various technologies just to accomplish something really, you know, apparently simple, I should say, because it isn't really simple. For instance, making a fire bow, you know, you have to pick a very springy sapling, you know, to use for your bow. You have to have a source of rawhide to use for the string or something equivalent. It's very, very handy if you want to do this to actually have a knife on your person, you know, that's quite sharp and versatile. And you have to have some whittling skills, and you just have to have a good eye for certain things, selecting kindling, knowing where to start your fire and how to do all these different things. And then it turns out to involve a lot of parts of your body, you know. You have to hold this the target plate with one foot. Usually it's your left foot, and you're kneeling on your right knee.
Mm-hmm.
And then you you put the stick of the fire bow down into this groove that you have to cut very carefully in the side of the target plate, which is also made of wood. And you have to have another little piece on the top, which serves as a bearing. And when you get it all set up right, you know, you really have to bow that thing under a lot of pressure and at a pretty high rate of speed before you get up enough temperature to get even a small amount of kindling going. And then once you do, you know, then it's a really artful situation, because usually it just starts off with a little glow, like a spark. And you have to nurture that and blow on it and feed it very gently with tiny, tiny combustible materials until you get a little fire going, and eventually build it up into something larger. But it's amazing, because you figure that this was a way of life at one time for people who wanted to start fire. And they had to learn all those skills in order to survive. Now, I took my son on a survival course a number of years ago up in Indian territory in North Jersey. And one of the challenges that was presented to all of the participants was exactly that, make a fire with nothing. Well, I'm telling you, it was amazing. Nobody succeeded, not anybody. And I was coaching my son, and he just didn't want to do it. He says, too much trouble. He says, don't you have any matches? But, I mean, it just goes to show you the mentality and how it has changed.
Yes. Do you find that you sort of remember or recall a deep-seated connection with nature when you revert to very simplistic methods of applying and causing elements to interact with themselves on such a basic or fundamental scale?
Well, I've always felt a pretty close connection with nature, especially when I used to just disappear out of the city into any wilderness that was available. I didn't really have too much of an opportunity to interact, you know, on a large scale basis, like gathering food and hunting animals and stuff like that, because most of the stuff that's available to hunt in New Jersey, at least in the area where I grew up, you wouldn't want to eat it anyway. But the thing I can tell you, which is interesting, is that I noticed that a lot of, let's call it innate skills that you probably have within you somewhere, begin to make themselves known. Mm-hmm. If you are in a relaxed state and you're not, you know, and you're not panicking. A lot of city slickers who get out in the wilderness just go nuts, and they lose all connection with everything, including themselves. But if you were used to wandering in the wilderness, one of the things that I found when I was pretty young was that you just know which direction to go in. I don't know how to explain it. You just know. Mm-hmm. Like if you want to go somewhere, you just kind of know how to get there. It's not so much like you have a map in your head. It's a feeling like, okay, it isn't even like saying, this direction feels like north. You know, yeah. You hear people say they're conscious of the magnetic field, for instance, or something like that, and they can navigate. But I think it's actually more primal than that. It's it isn't like saying this way is north, therefore that's east and that's west and behind me is south. It's more like, where am I trying to get to? And, oh, okay, it feels like this is the right way. And I've done that so many times, not recently, unfortunately, but when I was younger, that I really developed quite a sense of doing that. And it's a trait that I think all human beings have, but it's one of the things that we've lost over the years because you don't need it in the city so much.
Yeah, you know? That's what I was asking. So you answered that question appropriately. And I think that what you're describing is a feeling that we have in us. It's innate with us. It's a process of remembering it.
Yes, it is. And you know what's interesting also? It goes beyond that. It's almost like a sense because I don't know if I think I related this story to you once before, but it's probably worth retelling. On that same survival trip that I took my son on many years ago, it was sponsored by, I think it was the Delaware tribe, or one of those Indian tribes that's still surviving somewhere in the Jersey and Pennsylvania area. And one of the exercises that they made everybody do, which I thought was extraordinary, in the middle of the night, they wake you up. And I'm talking about the middle of the night, like 2 o'clock, 2:30. It's pretty darn dark, and there's nothing around. And you're out in the middle of nowhere in these little tents. And each individual that chooses to participate in this thing is brought a great distance away from the camp, out into the woods. And once you get there, you're blindfolded. And just about that time, there's a guy back in the camp somewhere who starts beating a drum. And you're supposed to return to the campsite only by listening to the sound of the drum. And you're not allowed to take the blindfold off. Now, each person has a guide that walks a little ways behind them, and of course they can see. They're not blindfolded. But the reason that they're there is because, you know, people could walk off the edge of a cliff or walk into a rock or something like that, you know, and they just, they only intervene if it looks like the person is going to be in danger.
Mm-hmm.
So I participated in this, and so did my boy, and I can tell you that the most amazing thing is at first, you know, you are, I wouldn't say panicking, but you are certainly missing your eyes. Let's put it that way. You really realize how dependent you are upon them. But then after a while, something really bizarre happens. Instead of seeing the way you normally see with all the details and everything that we're used to looking at, what happens is you kind of see a gray field. And in this gray field, there are darker patterns. And, I mean, you're certainly not seeing this with your eyes. I don't know what you're seeing it with, but it definitely works. And in this gray field, you can see these darker patterns. And the things that that show up very vividly as these darker patterns are actually objects. And another thing that happens, which is really interesting, is as you approach something, you begin to feel it with your body. I guess the best description that I could give you would be to say that it's almost like your etheric field is reaching out in front of you like a blind man with his hands out, and it's touching things and reporting back to you, because you can definitely feel stuff. I mean, I steered around every object and even surprised myself that I could do it. And, you know, there's lots of trees in the forest. I didn't walk into any of them. You can see them. You can feel them. But I tell you what did happen, which surprised me thoroughly. I walked all the way back to the edge of the compound where the cars were parked, because we did drive to this location. And I stepped out onto the tarmac, and of course I knew right away I was no longer in the forest, because you can feel the difference in your feet. But almost simultaneously, I walked right into the side of a van. And I didn't see that. And I didn't feel it. And when I got back to the guy that was running this thing, I reported that to him. I said, how is it possible that we come, you know, a half a mile or three-quarters of a mile through the woods? I avoided all the trees and rocks and vines and all the other garbage that was in the way, walked right into the beginning of the parking lot by just listening and guiding myself by the sound of the drum, and walked smack into the side of a parked van. And he said to me, and this guy was a Native American, and he said to me very, very matter-of-factly, he said, well, of course. He said, that's not alive.
Yes, I was going to comment something along those lines. Not to cut off your story, if you have more to say, I just wanted to comment that when you deprive an individual of their physical sight with the eyes, the pineal gland takes over at some point, and it becomes the point at which all this apprehension that you were feeling sort of subsides, and you get into the moment and start tuning in. It's a very natural process. It's one way to develop one's psychic abilities, is to perform that exercise. And that which is not made of nature, but was constructed by taking certain elements and putting them in unnatural combinations, is why your energy field basically didn't see it or didn't feel it, because as this Native American told you, it's not alive. You see, everything else is alive in that sense.
I'm very aware of that, but I also found out that you can learn to feel artificial things. It's just that the field is so much weaker. I actually experimented with that for quite some time, and it's a very simple thing to do. I mean, you can do it right in your own home. you know, you just close your, you aim yourself at a blank wall, for instance, close your eyes, and just take little tiny steps as you approach the wall. You already know the wall is there. It's not like it's a surprise or anything. But the reason you're taking the small steps, and then you stop and just kind of feel, and then you take a few more steps and stop and feel. And what I found was that when I was within 6 or 8 inches of the wall, I could feel it, especially with my face. It's just like, I don't know how to describe it. It's kind of like pins and needles, but it's not harsh. It's very, very subtle. And, you know, you can, it's some kind of a sensory thing, because you're definitely detecting something that's there. But I believe that you could probably strengthen that sense and eventually become pretty good at using it. But it's like anything else. If it's a dormant thing and you never do anything with it, you can't expect it to be developed to its peak capacity. You know what I mean?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, that you have shared that story before, but it's always interesting. You have another story that's quite interesting and hilarious, but I won't ask you to tell that one again.
Well, just remind me which one it is.
Oh, when you were powering up your dual synchronous capacitor.
Oh, yes, that one. Yeah, well, that doesn't necessarily fit with the overall theme of tonight's idea. But, yeah, it is an interesting, it is definitely an interesting story. One of these days, I'm going to write a book about all this stuff. That'll certainly be in there.
Yes, the Walter Cronkite part is hilarious.
Yeah, it really is. You know, the funny part, well, it's not funny, but the unfortunate part is that the guy who actually contributed that input, who was the man watching the Walter Cronkite news broadcast and told me what happened, he just passed away about a month and a half ago.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
He'll be sorely missed. He was a very dear friend.
Well, speaking about what you were describing, the thought entered my mind that we are so programmed, so educated and indoctrinated and mind-controlled that we sort of celebrate any moment to free or liberate ourselves from all those constraints. And that's another aspect of what you described, that really once you accomplish that, once you experience that, you don't ever lose that ability. You've awakened a part of your consciousness that's been asleep. And you begin to expand ever more from that moment on, all dependent upon how much you devote to continuing that process. I'm sure you would probably agree with that.
Oh, I do. And it expands into other areas of life, too. Like when I was involved with martial arts, which I miss very much, by the way. I just don't have the time right now, but when I was doing that on a fairly regular basis, especially the sparring, which I really enjoyed, the thing that never ceased to surprise me was how I could manage to block a punch or a kick that I never saw coming. I mean, I didn't see it with my eyes, but I knew it was there. And, yes. You know, that's another aspect of this whole thing. I think it just goes to prove that we are something greater than the body itself.
Yes. Absolutely, I agree. So, now you told this story as a basis of leading into something else, I'm sure. Do you want to continue?
Well, I thought it would be interesting to track, not in great detail, but at least in part, you know, the history of where we came from the standpoint of our utilization of energy, and where we are now, and where it might lead to if we're if we're not careful. And so what I did was I made a list of the various types of energies that human beings have used down through the ages. And we talked about fire. That's how all this got started. But another one, which a lot of people take for granted because they don't realize, they don't necessarily realize the connection, and that's animal power. Animal power is one of the earliest forms of the application of another form of power to do work.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you load an animal of burden, for instance, with sacks of grain or minerals or whatever it is you're transporting, that animal is working for you, and that's an expense of energy on its part. And in a more obvious application of that type of locomotive power would be, for instance, when an ox or a donkey or something is harnessed to a grist mill, for instance, and he's just forced to walk endlessly in a circle, dragging that big rock around while somebody throws grain underneath, and this thing rolls over and crushes and pulverizes the grain. That's actually a form of machine, and it was definitely powered by animal power. So that's a very old technology, and it goes back literally thousands of years. And we're still doing it today in different parts of the world. So it's really weird that, we have all this sophistication in some countries and extremely primitive facilities in other countries.
Then you had to...
It is a very old technique, however.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Well, I was just going to say, and I don't know if you have this on your list, but there was, soon after that, there was people power. They realized...
Oh, yeah, otherwise known as slavery.
Yes.
That's still very prevalent.
Yes. Absolutely.
And it's in several guises, one mm-hmm. of which is called freedom. But I don't know that we want to go there right now.
No. But I just thought I would bring it up just to remind ourselves, whether it was rowing a battleship for the Roman fleet or digging holes in the ground,
Or how about pushing those 4-ton blocks up the ramps to build all the pyramids in Egypt?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I have to tell you a funny anecdote about that. I was discussing the pyramid mystery with somebody a number of years ago. And he was a friend of mine. He was a Jewish fellow, as a matter of fact. And he was going to go into the rabbinical college in Long Island. And we used to have some pretty interesting discussions. And, of course, I was always of the impression that, even though I don't know how they were built, it certainly wasn't that way. But he was sticking, 100% to anything that was either in the Torah or the Bible or, one of the earlier explanations. And so we used to get into some pretty heated arguments. And so one of the things that came up was, I said, okay, you studied physics. I said, how do you suppose you can take a group of guys and drag, a 4-ton cut rock, across all this territory, and then, drag it up this supposed incline and put it into position? I said, the frictional coefficients are enormous. You'd need all these guys, hundreds and hundreds of them, just to pull the one block. And there is hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of blocks in some of these buildings. And he goes, well, of course, they used rollers. And I said, well, rollers? And he goes, yeah, rollers, And he said, you just cut... you cut a tree and you make a roller, and you know, you have several of them that you need or whatever. And he said that's how it was accomplished.
So you just
of course I didn't agree with him, you know, but I said, well, first of all, I said there aren't any trees in Egypt.
Yeah.
And he says, that's why. He says they use them all for rollers.
And who did they get to pick up that 4-ton block to put it on the rollers?
Well, they didn't go into that, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and you know, when you get into the specific parameters of those blocks and how finely chiseled they were to fit together and permit 1/1000th of an inch of adhesive that they still haven't figured out to hold them together. It's an amazing feat of architecture and scientific prowess, well beyond pushing or pulling 4-ton blocks up a ramp on logs.
Yeah, it's pretty astounding. And the other thing that's pretty interesting is, you know, the way these archaeologists, now you talk about brainwashing. Egyptologists have to be the creme de la creme of the brainwashing procedure, because it doesn't make any difference how the evidence stares them in the face. They will insist that their teaching is the only possible explanation. And it goes to the point of absurdity. Like, for instance, they insist that the tools that were used to chisel these rocks you were just talking about were all copper, because that's the Egyptians definitely had no steel. Out of the question. They couldn't have had steel. It wasn't invented yet. So they used copper. So you have copper chisels, and you have wooden mallets, and you are using that to chisel basalt, granite, limestone, and there's this other stone that's really, really hard. Oh, duralite, or something like that it's called. It's extremely hard. And you're using that to chisel these materials so that the accuracy of the finished product is measured in thousands. Now, the fact that the rocks are 100 times tougher material than the copper doesn't seem to register.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you could do that, you would have to have a copper smelting facility endlessly producing copper chisels at a rate that would be unprecedented, you know, just to do one stone.
That's sort of like trying to cut a filet mignon or a porterhouse steak with a bird feather.
Yeah, there you go. That's a reasonably good comparison. But anyway, it doesn't make any difference, the fact that it makes no sense. They still embrace that explanation, which is ludicrous. But anyway, the next thing on the agenda that was worth mentioning, in ancient Greece and also in ancient China, they had a considerable industry based on the understanding of various chemicals. I mean, the Chinese used, they invented gunpowder for one thing, which certainly changed the world. And they had rockets, they had flares, they had all sorts of things which were used in warfare and for other facets of their existence. The Greeks were very involved in different types of products for the military also, one of which was so-called Greek fire, which used to be shot from catapults, and that was a combination of sulfur and bitumen, and I forget what all else was in there, but it was, once it was lit, it was very difficult to put out, and, you know, there was an awful lot of chemical activity, and that's another type of energy that people don't think about too often, but it's definitely for real. Eventually, of course, it became the prime mover for artillery. And that was many years later, but nonetheless, it's the same energy at work. So you can see that as the cultures change and modify, that the use of energy goes hand in hand with it. Just going back to fire for a minute, you know, a parallel path of that development also brings us into the realm of metallurgy. You know, we have the Bronze Age, which came before the Steel Age, and you know, the smelting of metals for the weaponry and for the other things that were required during those various time periods was all dependent upon not only fire but also knowledge of chemistry. So, you know, you can see how they work hand in hand mm-hmm. with these various facets of what we call energy.
Don't you find it a bit ironic that you take primitive man in the way you've been describing, the acquisition of fire and the application of animal power to produce crops that feed and sustain life, and as the intelligence and the consciousness supposedly rises or increases, these inventions become weapons for mass murder. It doesn't make sense. You would think.
Well, I've never been able to understand exactly what it is that seems to propel man in that direction, but it's almost as if there's a propensity, you know, for that type of activity. There have been some pretty peaceful societies here and there. Ancient Egypt was reasonably peaceful country for quite a long time. But even they eventually got involved with wars and conquering and expanding their territories and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure what it is that prompts that, except maybe it's covetousness. Is that how you pronounce it? You just covet something that you don't have.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have enough force at your disposal, one day the king or whoever is leading you says, you know what? We want that. And, of course, the people who have whatever it is aren't interested in giving it up. So, you know, fight resolves, you know, it results. And then if the aggressor happens to be the more powerful, pretty soon they just take it away from the other party, whoever they are. And that seems to just have become a way of life in a lot of ways.
Oh, no, there's no doubt about it. And then those that control everything keep using that same method to obtain more control. It's bass-ackwards is the best way I can describe it.
It definitely is. But it's a very prevalent force in the modern world. And I think the United States has been guilty of that type of activity for a very long time, and even fostered similar behavior in a lot of other countries.
Mm-hmm. Well, just the way this, you know, since it's the Memorial Day weekend, maybe it's appropriate for me to say, the very thought of coming here on ships and murdering the people that lived here so you could take over the land in and of itself is probably one of the most obscene things to ever occur on this planet. And then to somehow justify this as some sacred act, it's insanity. It really is.
Yeah, well, anything can be justified if you skew your perspective far enough, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you put greed in front of it, like you were saying, covetousness, it's the same thing we have today, and it's gotten proportionately more out of hand than it was in the days.
Well, the interesting thing is, according to, you know, some of your input in cooperation with that of the general, it would appear that this is not only something which happens between cities and countries and continents, but perhaps even between planets.
Oh, yes.
So if that's the case, you know, it's a pretty universal failing of nature,
mm-hmm.
or of cognizant beings anyway.
I think ultimately you're talking about a group of individuals who are bent on acquiring the soul essence of those that do good, just to destroy it. They're destructive, they're evil, demonic, and all of the personality traits that go along with it. And yes, you're right. This is not the only place in our galaxy, or even in our solar system, where this is occurring. It's going on all over the universe, but it doesn't mean the universe is chaotic. There is an order to it, and at times, all these things have to be brought under the thumb of the Creator to quell this mass chaos that goes on.
Wish there would be a little quelling around here. But, you know, you brought up a very interesting point about the tendency to suppress or squash the people that try to do good. This afternoon, when I got home from work, I just decided to throw up my feet and watch a movie, and I picked out The Green Mile by Stephen King. I don't know if you've ever watched that.
Yes.
But the thing that's interesting besides the movie was I have the editor's cut, and in the special features section, they have an interview with all of the primary actors in the movie and also with Stephen King himself. And I think it was the director, Frank Darabont, I think is his name, who made this comment, but he said that one of the things that is so amazing about this movie, considering this huge black man who is endowed with this incredible gift, is the fact that, you know, he winds up going to the electric chair for something that he didn't do in the first place. But the reason that he found it so believable and so appealing in a very fundamental way, almost a primal way, to the audiences who watch it, is the underlying theme, which suggests that every once in a while, a saint, a visionary, a gifted individual, or a prophet, somebody like that, comes to Earth to bring goodness and accomplish something worthwhile. And it is the general tendency as an overall response from humanity to kill this person. And the perfect example, of course, is Jesus Christ. But, I mean, it's not just limited to the Christ figure. Look at what they did to Tesla.
Mm-hmm.
Look what they do to anybody that is here trying to help. It's amazing. It's like cutting off your nose to spite your face, but they do it all the time. And you picked up on that in your earlier comment about, you know, the tendency to lash out against people that are trying to do good in the world.
Yeah, this is really, that's the foundation of spiritual warfare. That's what's really going on. They prefer to give us a physical representation and control it through mental constructs, so that we have a two-dimensional existence as to who we are as beings. But in other words, it's all designed to stop us from being who we are, you see. And just like your explanation of going out into the woods and being blindfolded and having to make your way back without the usual senses and the usual frequency control that's available to you. You see, you begin to trust this frequency control as if it's your friend. How many times have people, with their eyes open, tripped over a rock and fallen down or walked off the edge of a cliff? It's happened. So having the eyes isn't necessarily an advantage if you don't know how to use them or if you can't recognize completely what you're seeing. If you can't differentiate that from a mirage, for example, or an hallucination. So, you know, our existence is, you know, I don't mean to sound like I'm preaching. I'm just saying that our existence is physical and is controlled through thought. We're told how to think. We're told what to think, when to think it. And it's those that step outside of that, those parameters of control, frequency control is what it is, that then elevate their own frequencies and they become in touch with their higher gifts. Now, these beings that just spend all their time destroying everything God has created obviously aren't acting in our best interest, nor are they abiding by universal laws. It's an abuse of, and really it's a an obscene abuse of universal law. Just the thought, well, I don't like this person, so I'm going to kill him. Or this person found out that the no good that I'm up to, so therefore that justifies me killing that person. That's insanity. For any reason, it's insane. But they build up all these illusory figures that stand out in history. You know, you have to have an antagonist, and the protagonist has to come and save the woman, the fair maiden, and then slay the antagonist. And they make the antagonist up to be anyone they choose. It's insane. Often, you know, I wish they would recognize that they are the antagonist and do themselves in. That would solve everybody's problem. You know, with all their wisdom.
For some reason, that it'll never come to that. It's always more interesting to direct your animosities to the outside rather than to yourself, you know.
Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, we're headed down a path, and I know you and the listening audience would agree, we're headed down a path where they would just as soon take everyone out with them. If they have to die, they want to make sure everyone else dies. You see? They're willing to gamble with those chances.
Well, that just goes to show you how nuts they really are.
Yes.
I mean, that is a totally unnatural way of behaving. I was talking to a friend of mine in New York not too long ago who happens to have a very pronounced working knowledge of human psychology about that very thing. And he was explaining to me that actually the whole thing starts out with a person who is very fearful of his environment or at least of other people.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody perhaps who started off being bullied or being teased, and reached a point where they decided that the only way that this process could be halted is if they were in a position to control the individuals around them, and that becomes a self-enhancing quality to the point where it becomes an obsession. And it no longer matters if they're just controlling the bully on the block. But pretty soon they want to control the whole block, and then they want to control the whole city, and, you know, it just grows from there. But at the core of the whole thing is fear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is very interesting, because that's what they wind up instilling in others.
And it's all based on illusion. It's not even there, really. It's not based on any tangible thing other than a few deranged thought forms that happen to create an upset in the physiological balance of a person's internal organs and muscles and nervous system. You know, it can be broken down pretty simply.
But the effects in the long run are pretty complex,
mm-hmm.
and pretty sensational. And when you start to realize there are really hundreds of thousands of yo-yos like that running loose on the planet, and they have a tendency to, you know, the old adage of birds of a feather stick together. You know, they have a tendency to help each other, at least to the point where they achieve the objective of overall control.
Mm-hmm. Well, through misapplication of certain precepts, be they scientific or ideological or political or even religious, the idea that you have to create something that's not real and invent stories about it as a means of controlling people is pretty pathetic. You're not really talking.
Even more pathetic is the fact that people fall for it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly.
You know what I mean? You can't blame the guy. You can't blame the con artist for trying. But, you know, the fact that people fall for it routinely. I mean, you know what Barnum said. There's one born every minute. He was right.
Yeah.
Anyway, before it gets too late, let me at least get to the next level of technological evolution, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that was pretty prevalent for many centuries was water and air power. You know, and people forget that we once had water-powered grist mills and all kinds of factories that were run by water power. And, of course, windmills for grinding wheat and even for pumping water. You know, that was something that was, gosh, it was an assumed technology for centuries that you had to have windmills and water wheels if you were going to have a successful civilization. And that's pretty old. And it also goes pretty much universally around the planet. You know, it's not like it was only in Europe, for instance. I mean, you can find applications of wind power and water power all over the place. And we mustn't forget that in that category of wind power is also sailing vessels. I mean, that's a very ancient and certainly well-used technology. My God, the Phoenicians were very ancient peoples and seafarers and explorers, and they sailed their ships all over the place. They found Phoenician writings in tributaries to the Mississippi River. They found, you know, Phoenician boat works in Brazil. They found Phoenician writings in the southwest part of the United States. They've been everywhere. Even though, you know, traditional history doesn't admit to it, they've left their artifacts and their engravings and everything else to prove that they've been there. And that was all done by wind power. So that's a pretty amazing thing. People don't realize what a part it has played in the history of our world.
Yeah, and all of that natural, all of those natural processes that you're describing were abandoned for metering, artificial power production. Or
but you know what's interesting about that, what you just said? Actually, the next thing on the list kind of falls right into line with what you were just saying, because steam power comes along here pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing about that is that once you start to do that, it requires fuel. Mm-hmm. And now the comes with that the business concepts that relate the sale of fuel to the people who are producing steam to do something with it, whether it's propelling a vessel or running a factory or running some kind of tools. It doesn't make any difference. Pumps.
Locomotive.
Steam pumps go back way, way back. They found remnants of steam-powered equipment in Roman mines, for God's sakes. But even if you don't want to go to that extreme, it's not so hard to see the connection between that type of workhorse, a mechanical steam-powered device, and the merchant who sells the fuel to run the thing, whether it's cut wood or coal or oil or gasoline. It doesn't matter what it is. The relationship is there. And you pointed out, of course, the steam train, which came along a little bit later, but that's a very good example, because by the time we were using steam for that purpose, and there was a time in the United States when railroads were king. I mean, they made the highway system look like it was non-existent. And that was all run on steam for, at least two centuries. And, there were any number of businesses which were supplying coal and even wood in some cases to these steam-powered trains. And some of your first magnates were people who decided that they could get very wealthy by controlling the fuel that was being consumed by these machines. And then eventually they bought the railroads besides. And then they had it all.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, we got the greed thing going. The idea that everything has to belong to one group or one person or whatever. The mania for control seems to seep into the picture from every direction.
Mm-hmm. The mania for pretending one is God really is what it boils down to.
Well, that must be a very amazing form of self-hypnosis or something to convince yourself that you're that magnanimous, because if you really understand the universe, even, I don't even mean in detail, I mean just the most superficial understanding of what's out there, it's totally impossible not to be humbled by it. And so these people that have these super egos, they must just blot out any input on that scale of things and bask in their own greatness. Otherwise, it would be impossible for them to behave the way they do.
Mm-hmm. So we've covered now all the way up to steam power. And then, of course, you're probably going to get more in the area of your work, I would presume, after that.
Well, it doesn't take very much. I mean, steam power, I think, came into various applications as early as the 1790s. But by the time you get into, and possibly earlier, by the time you get into the electric area, of course, there was a lot going on in the 1800s in that direction. But the real shining star in that whole situation was Nikola Tesla's contributions, and that was as early as 1888 when he came out with the polyphase power transmission system and the three-phase motor, three-phase generator, and all of that stuff, which definitely changed the world. But there again, with that leap in technology, two other things happened. Everybody wanted electricity in their homes for lights, for heat, for appliances, for entertainment, for whatever it could bring. And the moneymongers were right there. They had to control every aspect of it from the day that it took off, you know, right down to our present time today. Anybody that would even dare to come up with a plan which would sidestep or circumvent, you know, their little empire of centralized power generation and distribution stands to run into an enormous amount of resistance. And that's putting it mildly.
Mm-hmm. All the while you're describing this, and I don't intend to take us off on a tangent, but there is this underlying power that's acquired through this system of what we call wealth, financial wealth, putting a value on metal objects, metallic objects, and then even to paper objects, giving it this false value that is symbolic of a certain type of power that is encroaching upon humanity's freedom, all the while it's advancing itself technologically through time. You know, the two go hand in hand. Make wars, make weapons, kill people, steal their money, or steal their land. Acquire more things through that process. It's a parallel process, and it's probably the real fuel behind all of these advances.
Well, that's the part that's so weird. You know, it's an evil process that has spin-offs which are good, but the primary motivation is wicked. You know, there's no need for that. And yet, it really makes you do some soul searching, because the next most realistic question to ask is, if people didn't have that tenacious tendency of greed and covetousness and ambition and all these different things that lead to evil, and they were just very docile creatures, without those tendencies, where would humanity be? Would we have progressed regardless, or would we just be like the Eloy in the Time Machine movie, just sitting around, you know, lollygagging, not doing anything in particular, eating fruit, chasing girls, and doing all those things without any objectives to life at all?
Well, those that were controlling that system are not unlike those controlling this system, the Morlocks.
I know. The Morlocks were pretty much the same type of setup. As a matter of fact, you know, often wondered.
I misspoke. I said Morlocks. I meant Morlocks, actually. But what's
well,
in
I knew what you meant, but there are Morlocks, you know, but that's another whole deal. I just was wondering if there was even a possibility that H.G. Wells, when he wrote that story, wrote it as a, you know, as a parallel to what was actually going on in the world, because he was a very well-educated guy. He could easily have seen, what was being done to society in his time. And a lot of this, of course, has its roots in England, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he could have written that whole thing just as a disguised version of what was actually going on.
Yes. Yes, no doubt. Well, I didn't mean to send us off on a tangent, but it became increasingly evident to me that there's this parallel, you know, as more control is taken, there's more value put on the amount of money that somebody has. And you can't eat the money. It doesn't keep you alive in and of itself. In that sense, it's not natural.
No, but it has become equated with everything, so it's pretty hard to disassociate it with survival.
Yes.
Yeah, it is labor in stored format, after all.
Now, after Tesla's invention of alternating current, and I suppose we should include Thomas Edison's research into direct current, Tesla went way off on a limb, if you will, in his research, and he started incorporating really unearthly concepts into his work. He figured at this stage everything else is bringing the powers of the universe into play as far as his inventions and his discoveries and his research.
He actually talks about some really far out stuff. I mean, he even had this one paper, I forget which one it was, where he talks about, you know, in his vision, that the planet itself might eventually be steered on a different course and be used as a giant vehicle for exploring the universe. And, you know, he talks about all kinds of things, tapping into the cogwheels of nature on a level which, you know, surpasses anything which has been done to date. He just talked about so many things that nobody could keep up with his mind. It was so far out there. But my feeling is that when you get to a certain level, not just in your own research, perhaps, and in your own understanding of nature in general, but when you get to a certain level of trust with the universe itself and your relationship with it is very open and very honest, things are going to flow into your mind from that source, whether it's the Godhead or call it what you want, you know, super consciousness or the universal consciousness. You start tapping into things, and when they manifest in your mind, you know, they're so far out there that you even have trouble relating them to another person, or maybe even understanding them yourself. I know that some of the things that I've been inspired with have taken years to figure out what they mean. And yet they must mean something, because the results that you get from the same mechanism are often very tangible and very real. And I think that there's a very strong possibility that you can, By using that facility in your own consciousness and your own mind, you can propel yourself to a place where you can only really exist there in the most tenuous fashion, either mentally or spiritually, because it gets to the point where so much is required by way of technology, information, cooperation, wealth, and God knows what else, to make some of these things happen, that for all intents and purposes, only God can do them. But that doesn't mean you can't be aware of them. And that's got to be an enormously frustrating experience, even though it's also a joyous one, because you start to see the way things work, and you start to say, wow, I can do that, or I could do that if. But the if becomes bigger and bigger and bigger until it's the impossible to surmount. And I think that some of these people that control the earth get on that type of a ride. Maybe not so much from the scientific point of view, but maybe from the social or civilizational aspect, and they start to see how things could be if everything was controlled and this and that and the other thing. And they realize that the wealth that it's going to take to do that type of thing is astronomical. And so then they come up with these schemes, you know, which result in illicitly milking the entire globe of its wealth just so that they can screw around with their pet theories and ideas. And, you know, that type of thing is inherently wrong.
Isn't that the definition of a parasite?
not only a parasite, but a psychopath. It becomes to the point where, you know, you can't control it anymore. It just becomes like an overall obsession. But anyway, maybe we should take the next step, because I think we're running out of time. The next thing that's on the agenda after electrical, of course, is nuclear. And I'm sure there's other stuff besides nuclear, but the thing about nuclear power is that, you know, it started off as a weapon. We used it to end the war, supposedly, in 1945. And then we started building reactors and all these other contraptions that work off this type of power. But now we're to the point where, either through a nuclear war, an exchange of weapons based on the destructive capacity of this agency, we could wipe out the human race, or through these interesting little side actions, like the tragedy that just occurred in Japan, that type of thing could be used to spread radiation all over the place, which would have the same effect on a longer time schedule. But the point is that here's a technology which is like a two-sided coin. One side of it has all kinds of interesting advantages. The other side of it, you know, has all kinds of negative aspects and problems associated with it. But it could wind up being the agency which could return the human race to the Stone Age. And there we are back at the beginning again. And that was the whole point of starting with fire and winding up at this particular plateau of achievement, simply because of the fact that we are now at the crossroads where we can go either way. You know, we can go down the road to mass destruction, radiation poisoning, mutations, biological disintegration, and God knows what else, which will ultimately cull the race, and whoever survives is going to have to start all over again. Or we can go the other way and say, there's got to be something better than nuclear, because that's never the end of the road. And let's expand our consciousness and move in that direction, because we are supposed to be the stewards of this planet, and it's our responsibility to accelerate its evolution and bring people's consciousness, you know, as far up the scale towards the Godhead as humanly possible. And that's a responsibility, and it takes an effort. And so we're at that crossroads right now.
You know, there's another aspect of nuclear power or nuclear weapons that has found its way into the medical industry somehow. And you think about this, it's life-threatening. It's a life-threatening event if a nuclear power plant suffers a meltdown and an escapement of radioactivity. When you build a bomb and drop it on a city or a couple of cities like they did in Japan after the Japanese had already surrendered, in fact, they did many, many things to the Earth and to the solar system and likely the galaxy. Even this locale of the universe suffered from that insanity. And it's happened before, so you wonder why there is such an interest in what's going on the planet from outside. Yet they take this destructive power, this deadly power, and by reducing it, they've sold people on the idea that it's good. It'll make you healthy, used under certain circumstances. Now, I'm not saying they're using uranium or plutonium, but radiation is radiation, and if it can kill you, in the two instances, most likely it's going to kill you in the third, in the medical application. And not many people who have gone through chemotherapy or some sort of nuclear medicine have survived beyond 5 years. After the fact, they may have bought themselves 5 years in reducing the size of a tumor. A knife will cut out the tumor just as maybe even easier than. So it depends on where the tumor is as to them deciding on that application. But it's insane.
Well, you don't have to convince me too much. I agree with you. But as you pointed out, you know, it's something which was merchandised to the public in the right kind of a wrapper and the right kind of a package. And now everybody just kind of believes in it, and they don't think there's any problem with it. But, you know, you don't have to go to that extreme to see this mechanism at work. If you watch TV, I mean, any given day of the year, you'll see a myriad of various products being advertised, you know, for different medical purposes. And the string of warnings and side effects are much more pronounced and much more volatile than whatever the thing was designed to do in the first place. And that doesn't deter anybody from buying it. And I mean, they don't just flash them across the bottom of the screen quietly. The guy actually reads them to you. You know, this will make your hair fall out. This will give you wrinkles. This will cause you, you know, to have bleeding ulcers. This will do this. This will do that. There's a whole list.
Oh, yeah. You commit suicide, but call your doctor. You know?
Yeah. But buy the damn thing anyway. It's okay.
Well, you just described the power of suggestion.
Well, of course. Isn't that part of the whole programming issue?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of those other powers that we don't really pay attention to. But it's this requirement that we must conform. You know, it's you have to have insurance for when you get sick, you see. The insurance doesn't make you well. Why not approach the problem from a solution-oriented perspective and determine what causes illness? Well, we know they're manufacturing bacteria and every kind of disease, and they want to force us to inject it directly into the bloodstream. Can you become any more obscene and obvious in your intentions than that? We're going to create laws that you have to do this. Or then the penalties come, you see.
Everything is about separating you from every dime you own.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yes. Well, you and I talked about this Hadron Collider some months ago. You remember that? And we haven't.
Vividly, yes.
Yeah, we haven't heard much about that. Is that because it has failed, or it's because they're trying a way to weaponize it now and use that somehow to gain more power, maybe on another planet? Who knows?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, but I can tell you one thing that I do know. Whatever they did with it, it didn't tear a hole in the space-time continuum, thank God, or we wouldn't be here talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. That's,
well,
that's,
you never know. Maybe some of our programs and some of the arguments we presented, you know, were actually considered seriously. Perhaps they just they decided to forego certain experiments. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
That would be nice if that was the case.
Yeah. Well, there are some other powers that we haven't talked about, or at least they're applicable to interplanetary travel, and that's anti-gravity and anti-matter propulsion systems, which operate differently but serve genuinely the same purpose. One is to get off the planet, and the other is to move through space. Maybe we can tackle that on an upcoming show if you would like to.
Sure, why not? We've seen we've never been shy about tackling anything else.
That's true. That's true. Well, Jim, it's been interesting. I hope you got to say everything you wanted to say tonight, although I know you could go on for hours and just scratch the surface of the immense knowledge and experience that you have. But I want to thank you for your contribution to the show. And we're getting close to our fourth year. Our fourth year anniversary of Evident Footprints coming up here. And
when is that, by the way?
That's in the month of June. I have to look at the date, but it's like in the middle of June. So we're about 2 weeks or so away from that time. Got to go back and just...
Didn't we also collaborate on the other earlier show before Evident Footprints? How long was that on the air?
Well, that was always Evident Footprints. It was just on another network.
Oh, I see. Okay.
We back then we were doing 3-hour shows. If you remember that.
Oh, I remember very vividly.
So
I had toothpicks holding my eyelids up the next day after those shows.
The next day, but you were enjoying yourself during the show. I know that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we did some interesting marathon shows. I remember when we used to take a break in the middle for a few minutes, you know, with different sponsors and stuff, and I was always very grateful to run to the men's room.
Well, Jim, I want to wish you a very pleasant and patriotic Memorial Day. I look forward to our next discussion. Let's get into this concept of anti-gravity and also antimatter propulsion. I think we'd find it interesting.
I'll be happy to embrace that with you.
Okay. Well, you have a great weekend and a good night, and I'll see you next week here on Evident Footprints. Folks, that wraps it up. You've been listening to Evident Footprints on bbsradio.com. And tonight's special guest, scientist, inventor, Jim Murray. Special thanks to Windtalkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints. Over at BBS Radio, we had Don Newsom on the sound tonight. I'd like to thank Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible. And most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday night when my special guest will be Dr. A. Truott. I want to wish everyone a happy Memorial Day, a safe Memorial Day. Do pray for all the people who are suffering from inclement weather and abnormal storms. Pray for peace around the world. And certainly have a talk with God. That can't be stressed enough. In the meantime, I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.